Welcome to Educated Conjecture, an Ipsos podcast that combines what the public thinks with what the experts think. Each week, Ipsos's Mike College and Sean Simpson are joined by an informed guest to discuss a current or emerging issue. Does when you're born shape who you are? In this episode, Bobby Duffy, director of the Policy Institute, King's College London, and author of The Generation Myth, joins Mike and Sean to discuss how generations shape societies and why generational differences aren't as distinct as we think. And now, on to the episode.
Sean, how are you today?
I'm well, Mike.
Are you in Calgary? Are you home already?
No, I'm in Calgary right now. This is now my second client presentation since the, pandemic, I guess, or during the pandemic. And it just feels great to be re-engaging in real life. It's quite invigorating, actually.
Well, that's good. We'll get to our guest in 2 seconds, but do you have a stat of the day or a stat of the week?
I do.
Or just anything you want to share with us?
let's keep it confined to Ipsos statistics, I think. What I wanted to share was we just recently released a poll about the situation in Ukraine. So I thought I might share a stat or two about that. So when we asked global citizens whether they believe that the or essentially what level of risk does the war in Ukraine pose to both the world and their country, most acknowledge that it poses a risk to the world, 82%, and Canadians are actually right on that average at 81%. But we asked whether they believe that the war poses a risk to the country. 61% of global citizens believe it poses a risk to their own country, but only 52% of Canadians, below the average. I guess they figure since we're North America and not Europe, it may not be quite as impactful. But dare I suggest that Canadians might be forgetting who our northern border is shared with.
Yeah. We might be a little bit complacent based on who our southern border is shared with as well. So I'll go completely domestic. As you know, we track on a regular basis how people feel about the world. And so I just wanted to throw out a couple numbers that I thought were interesting. From October 20 to March 2022, just a couple tracking data. So you're going to go back to October 20, we're somewhat starting to see some light at the end of the tunnel of the pandemic. We have a vaccine finally. People are starting to get it. The economy has proven far more resilient than we thought it was going to be. Maybe go back to spring of 20. But so from October 20, where you'd think things would start to get better, we've seen the number of people who say our society, our system is corrupt, climb from 57% to 64% in Canada, so up 7 points. And on the flip side, those who agree with the statement, I trust government and the political system to do what is right, from 58% down to 43%, so down 15%. So at a time when, arguably we've got our proverbial stuff together, we've got vaccines rolling, we've got the economy rolling, up to today, it's been a pretty, and it hasn't been like a fall off in, January of this year. It's been a pretty steady decline over that period. So obviously some disconnect between sort of the macro progress we're making and how people feel about it. So
that's a discussion that we could unpack perhaps with another guest speaker sometime.
Yes, we could. But today we have, it's always fun. We have someone from the UK. We have Bobby Duffy, who's the director of the Policy Institute at King's College in London. The great thing about having, hi, Bobby, how are you?
Yeah, very good. Great to be here. Thanks, Mike and Sean.
The great thing about having Brits on is pretty much all you have to say is fish and chips, and Canadians are pretty impressed because of the accent. we're easily
never together. Worked for me. Never worked for me.
So, Bobby, before we get a short overview of your book, I'm hoping you can give us just enough so that we can discuss it, but not enough that people don't need to buy it or right? So we're here to shill for you. Can I ask you what a director of the Policy Institute does?
So I'm part of King's College London, and our main task is to make sure that academic research has some impact on policy and practice. So there's an awful lot of taking great research from colleagues and making the connection to policymakers and others and the media, making sure that it gets out there and shapes debates and actually influences decision makers. So that's the main focus. Yeah.
Excellent. That's great. Well, thank you for joining us. I know it's pub time in the UK, so this is,
it's always pub time.
So you penned a book, Generations: Does When You're Born Shape Who You Are? Mm. Can you give us the Coles Notes version of it?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, what interesting fact to start with is in the US, it's called the generation myth. Why, yeah, when you're born matters less than you think. Because I think there's a North American discussion, I think, which I think takes in Canada as well as the US, where there's a bit of disillusionment with some of these generational analyses that you'll see and stories in the media in particular. And that's one of the key themes of the book. So if you're summing it up in one sentence, the main argument in the book is that generational thinking is an incredibly powerful idea about how societies change over time that we really need to understand if we want to understand today and the future. But it's one that's been horribly corrupted by endless myths, stereotypes, and cliches about generations from poor analysis. So the job of the book is actually to separate out the different types of effects that influence societal change, of which generational change is one of them, an important one of them, but it's only one of them. And quite a lot of what I'm doing in the book is separating myth from reality about what's truly different between generations. And there are really important things that are different between generations. You think of the economic circumstances that different generations have grown up with. You think of the pandemic, obviously, as a generational generation shaping event. There are some real things, but it gets lost in all of this nonsense about millennials killing the napkin industry, or really bold claim,
a run on avocado toast.
Yeah, exactly, that type of stuff. There's some brilliant cliches about, I cut my hand slicing my avocado, and now I can't fix my top knot, about millennial problems. And it's sort of that type of theme is incredibly prevalent. And it leaks into real world stories of constant advice to millennials and now Gen Z as the youngest generation, mm-hmm, about how if they just gave up their fancy coffees and their avocados and their Netflix, they could buy a house. And mm-hmm, it's just not true. There's much bigger economic forces at play than, yeah.
Yeah, and also a constant hope that this is the generation that's going to save us, right? That this next generation is going to be the one that lifts us from the current despair that we've all gotten ourselves into generation over generation.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. And that's kind of less commented on, but I think really important, and I do talk about it a fair bit in the book, is people like Barack Obama in particular, for very good reasons, very noble reasons, I'm sure, is constantly lionizing the next generation to be the ones that are going to come and sort out whether that's equality, racism, or the climate challenge. It's always this sort of sense of kicking the can down the road to this coming savior generation. And it's just, again, just not true. There is no big breaks in lots of those types of things. It's more of a gradual evolutionary change in behavior and attitudes that you see over time, rather than a distinctive savior generation coming down the road. And it's really, really problematic. And we may get onto climate change in particular, because that's one of the bad examples of this, because it really, all it does is divide people by saying the old people don't care about climate and it's only the young people that are championing it, which is not true in the data. May have been, 10 years ago, but even then exaggerated, but now definitely not true. And all we're doing is dividing people by age when we really need to be bringing them together and creating these false sense of separation is destructive to the cause, as well as creating a greater sense of generational tension that doesn't really exist on issues like this.
So, Bobby, what's the sin? Why have we labeled things as generational rather than attributed to other things? Is it, and I don't want to get too technical, but is it because we're conflating correlation with causality, things that appear in a simple, stratification of sample appear to be generational because there are differences by age, but they're really caused by something else?
Yeah. I mean, the main analytical tool in the book, which is more, you know, it's really simple, is that there are just three effects that explain all change in societies. There are cohort effects, as they call it, which is these generational effects. But then you also have life cycle effects, where we change as we age. People go through different life stages, and their behaviors and attitudes and beliefs change with those, whether they're leaving home, getting a job, having kids themselves, retiring, all of those types of things have an effect. And then the third effect is period effects, where everyone in society is affected to some degree by either sudden events like a pandemic or slow evolutionary change of changing fashions or norms. And the biggest cause of the myths and stereotypes is mixing up these effects. So you will often see claims about Gen Z are X, Y, and Z, in terms of their different types of behaviors or attitudes. So take one example of both millennials and Gen Z have been accused of being the most materialistic generation ever, where they're only interested in getting rich or famous or those types of shallow things. And what that's really measuring is that young people tend to be more focused on getting rich or being famous, and then they grow out of it as they get older. So all I do in the book is plot those trends by generation, not by age group. And it quite often separates those things out, where you'll see millennials were the ones that were most focused on getting rich when they were in their late teens, early 20s, and then it declines as they get to into their 30s. And then they're replaced by Gen Z, who've got a very similar level that as millennials in terms of focus on materialistic things, and then they will decline. And then Gen X, my generation, would have been the same before that. So we're ascribing a characteristic to a cohort and implying they're going to take it with them throughout their lives, when really it's a one-off effect about being a particular age. So that's one of the big reasons, is we conflate these three different effects.
We used to do a big, for about a decade, we had a study for the government on young people. Under 30 was the category. And when we look at it, this older Canadians, there was a tipping point around, this is a couple of decades ago, 25, 26, 27, where suddenly we start to think a lot and attitudinally like our parents. There was just a shift, right? And you could, to your point on lifestyle, you could almost look at all of these people back then and go, they got kids, they had mortgages, et cetera. But I also wonder the effect of the media. I mean, if you go back 20 years ago, I started to realize how smart my dad was when we started to consume the same news media, because we got the same news, right? There's only a handful of channels. But I look at my kids today and they're fed a digest of Instagram and, you know, whatever she subscribes to. The other one's solely on Reddit. So we get very different news sources, very different gatekeepers. So I wonder if some of those lifestyle effects that were and lifestyles have changed, right? They're buying houses later, they're having children later, is likely to delay some of that shifting.
Interesting. I mean, one of the real generational effects is delayed adulthood. That is different now between cohorts who are going through early life stages now compared to cohorts before, in terms of leaving home later, leaving education later, leaving home later, getting married later, having kids later. All of those types of things are true. So people are going through these stages later. And that is a really important thing for businesses and politicians and others to recognize, is that has shifted over time. But there's a really interesting mix of things that are delayed and things that are lost to that generation. So things like sexual experiences are coming later for people. That is absolutely true. But things like house purchase, for example, particularly the large majority of developed countries, including definitely US and UK, I'm sure it's the same in Canada. Is lost to people. They're never going to get there. at the same proportions as previous cohorts of people in the same socioeconomic circumstances. That if you had been born just 20 years earlier with the same sort of income and wealth or wherever your resources are, you'd have been on a different trajectory. When I plot the charts of this, I'm kind of tracking different generations over time. You can just see Gen X were the first to get hit by it, where it looked like we were going to go up and meet previous generations at the same level of home ownership. And we just got deflected away in the early 2000s with the house price boom, then bust. And millennials never got going at all on this. And they're just in very different life courses, just purely on the basis of when they were born, not their individual place in the socioeconomic spectrum.
Yeah, they're where they were born in the economy.
Yeah, where they were born in the history of all these circumstantial things that led towards the baby boomer generation in particular, and then chunks of the early Gen X having incredibly propitious circumstances for their home ownership, where or lower prices, very lax lending rules on how you compared to today, growing economy, growing wages. All of those types of things, just the circumstances, utterly different for younger generations coming through.
I mean, one of the big, you can say either millennials or Gen Z and boomers, is always who has it tougher? Mm-hmm. We had 21% interest rates back in the 80s, and young people are like, yeah, but a house didn't cost eight times your salary. Do you have the definitive answer for this, Bobby?
Of course. Do you remember the Four Yorkshiremen sketch from Monty Python? This was set in like the 60s. That would have been baby boomers' parents talking about their terrible housing circumstances, where it goes from, you know, one room through to tarpaulin over a hole, through to living in a septic tank, to living in a lake, and all of this sort of stuff. And then a shoebox on the motorway was kind of the last one, where everyone's saying, oh, I had it much worse than you. And the end of that sketch is, and you tell that to young people today and they won't believe you. And that is such a good example of how we always have this sense of this generation, the coming generation, have just got it easy, and we were the ones who suffered through all of that. And in lots of ways, the myths and stereotypes around generations help reinforce that. Because if you look in the media, you'll see lots of complaining on millennials and then Gen Z's behalf about rat-infested or cockroach-infested rental properties that they're in now. But that's not the difference. That has always been the case. But housing standards have increased, for example, and it's what has utterly changed is they can't afford the houses in the first place. And that is such an important part of wealth generation right now, that has changed. So we point at the wrong things quite often on what's actually important in generational difference.
And I suppose that, you know, the other big difference is that, you know, my parents were fine with linoleum. Well, I want hardwood and granite, or actually it's quartz now, right? So it's no wonder it costs more when the materials that you're using are more expensive. But it's always a debate. I guess it's the okay boomer. You know, that's the response that you hear now as sort of the you don't understand me and my plight and how it's different from yours.
Yeah, no, I look, there's definitely things. The world has moved on and improved in lots of ways. And when you ask people actually in Ipsos studies about what are the things that have got better or worse across generations, then there's quite a lot of recognition that things have got worse. As in, when you ask, can young people today expect a better or worse life than their parents, you will get more people saying worse today in places like the UK, Canada, and the US than better. And back in the 2000s, early 2000s, late 1990s, it was the other way around. You'd get more people saying better rather than worse. So there is a recognition of that. But then when you break it down a bit more into different domains, then there's a clear recognition that things like entertainment, travel, education, education, health, all of those types of things have improved. So it's swings and roundabouts. But in the end, Sean, I suppose I'm more of a sympathizer with younger generations, because these big economic factors of wage stagnation, less reliable employment, more gig type economy employment, greater debt because you're paying more for your education, incredible house prices that you just can't hope to break into. They're the big things that are really affecting their future life chances. Yes, it's true. The standards of, say, what type of flooring you want, or those types of things have gone up. But the big picture stuff is not awesome for big chunks of them. And that's the bit. So I do worry. We had there's a TV celebrity here who had one of those very typical advice for young people wanting to own their own homes of stay in, don't go out for any meals, have all of these things, take a packed lunch to work and all of that type of stuff. And the reality is it would take them 54 years to save up the deposit on this average house in order to, if they made all of those types of savings. So it's a different context, but equally a lot of things have got better as well, and you shouldn't forget that.
Yeah. Do you see, I guess not, because you said you're a little bit despondent about it, hope on the policy horizon? Because I don't see a whole lot of, at least from where I look, I hear politicians talk about low unemployment, great GDP growth, all the things that people don't care about, and patting themselves on the back as they announce bigger spending programs. They're arguably, people are going, well, it's not really what I want you to spend money on, or there doesn't seem to be any creative policy, I guess, is my point.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. We've got all these true generational challenges and a lack of imagination in policy and politics on this, which is partly driven by generational dynamics as well, because you have got a wealthy baby boomer generation coming through. It's called a boom because there's a lot of them and they vote a lot. So they have quite a lot of power, economic and political power, and making those sorts of longer term investments. And this is, the book is not at all a baby boomer blaming book, because there's a whole series of trends going on that have pushed us more and more into short-termism in our policy making and politics that make it really hard to make those long-term plans about how do you get out of this type of sense of stagnation. And one really important thing, just as an aside, is a lot of it is put as young versus old. But the problem with that is it kind of messes up. It completely forgets the incredible connections we've got up and down the generation. So it's a problem for everyone in society if we don't think the future is going to be better for our kids, because we really want it to be better for our kids. So it's not just the young people themselves who are worried about this. This is more generational, the end of generation on generation progress is a threat to our faith in the system overall, because grandparents, parents, all have a vested interest in actually we've got to get things to be better for our kids and grandkids.
So I'm tail end of the boomers. I know I don't look it, but
hey, it ain't so, Mike.
At least not on an audio podcast. I don't. Arguably, it's going to get worse before it gets better, because the reason I pointed out I'm a tail end of the boomers, I'd like to pat myself on the back and say I work really hard, but there is a little bit of circumstance. Houses were cheaper. You were able to get in, et cetera, et cetera. So wealth is accumulated for the entire generation. This will get passed down to the next generation, and it'll be impactful, but less impactful than the growth that we've had. But then it gets to the next generation, and it's going to get weaker. Mm. And then what, right? And I know that's a long ways off still, but now's the time to adjust for two generations out, because we're going to hit a point where there's no wealth passed down that has a significant lift.
That's a really interesting point. I haven't really, because I'm worried about the next step. I'm worried about that first step, because, there is incredible. The economic story of the past 30 years has been the increase in private wealth. That is compared to wages and income. It's just become a completely different economy where how you feel about yourself is mostly based on your wealth, because wages have not gone up very much across lots of countries, and but wealth has gone up enormously. I think the story of the next couple of decades is how that wealth trickles down, but how it trickles down very unevenly, because not all baby boomers made it big by any means. So that is a lot of the wealth is concentrated in that top third, also of that baby boomer generation. And so it's going to flow down very unevenly. And so there's a lot of worry from sociology point of view about the extent to which this reinforces existing inequalities. And there's talk in the US of an incipient caste system where you've got this real sense of where you end up. It relies entirely on where you began. In which is not great from American Dream point of view, but it's the same in the UK. I'm sure the same in Canada. Same sort of thing of you're getting these increasing boundaries. What happens after, you know, third generation down? You're right, because it will get diluted as the government takes more each stage. And where does it all go after that?
Won't be a problem in the college house, the whole caste system, because there's a couple of kids on the outside right now. So I'm gonna.
Well, that's good if you can mix it up a bit, Mike, through cutting off your kids. That's very altruistic of you.
Just to shift slightly, Bobby, as you might know, I run the our election polling here in Canada, and my background is political science. And one of the things that we, you know, learned throughout school and sort of held to be true was that as people age, they become more conservative. Now, what we're seeing in Canada, though, is, you know, there's a rise of populism, and this is obviously not just in Canada, but elsewhere as well. And many of the people who are supporting these more populist leaders, in many cases, tend to be younger as well. So if I just refer back to the notes I took when you were describing the thesis of your book, we're looking at either cohort, lifestyle, or period effects. Is this true? Does this still hold true that people become more conservative as they age, which I guess would be a lifestyle effect?
Yeah, life cycle. Yeah.
Or life cycle, right. Rather, sorry.
Yeah. No, it does, but it's not the only. Politics is, as you all know, Sean, one of the most complex areas to predict, and it's because it is such an intricate interplay between those three effects. I found it really useful to think of election polling and predictions in light of those three things, because you've got them all going on at once, where you've got quite powerful cohort effects, where when you grew up, it's been shown to affect your voting patterns throughout life. So you can see there's lots of political cohort-based studies that will show if you grew up under a great Democratic president in the US, you will tend to be more democratic than others, holding everything else constant. But if you grew up under a really rubbish democratic president, you will be anti-democratic more than others. So you've got that kind of cohort effect going on. Then you do have a political life cycle effect, which there is still that tendency towards conservatism or traditionalist parties as you age. And it is an effect, and you can measure it. So in the UK, it's worth about 0.35 of a percentage point of vote for every year of age. So it's not huge, but it's not insignificant. It adds up over sort of time. But obviously the big thing in politics, you have these massive period effects of, you know, in our country, a prime minister that's doing really noteworthy things, but not in a good way. So he is changing perceptions of connection to his party now because of people worrying about elements of his around COVID. So you've got all of those things going on. It's such an intricate pattern to be unpicked, and events are incredibly important in determining those types of things. So in the UK, for example, we don't particularly have that strength of populism, of more right-wing populism growing among the young, and I think that there's loads of explanations for that, but I think one really important one to bear in mind from a political science point of view is that a clear trend that we have put culture change closer to the heart of our politics than economic factors in the last few decades. There's great analysis of political manifestos over the past 50 years or so that shows the balance of focus in manifestos across 21 different countries has shifted from, it used to be economics was most talked about. Now it's cultural change, whether that's immigration or whatever the issue is. And then in the UK, we've had that supercharged by Brexit and all the discussions about where that was going, where the country was going culturally, on immigration, but lots of other things too about culture war type issues. And that's put, when you put culture at the heart of politics, you are automatically building in an age divide, because young people are more comfortable with culture change and older people are less comfortable with culture change because they grew up in a different environment. So we've got this dynamic, very clear dynamic now, of a much more Labour supporting left wing young people, biggest age gaps between young and old on Labour versus Conservatives in the UK for the last couple of elections. So a real mixed picture across different countries. But I do think, I think there is a bit of a common theme that you do see in other countries like the US, where this increasing focus on culture change in politics, and you get it in Canada quite a lot.
Quite a lot.
You've seen quite a lot with Trudeau and and all of the protests. That sense of what sort of country do we want to be is very, very important. It's increasingly important in politics. And
it almost seems like preaching to the converted, because everybody almost universally agrees on some of the culture change aspects that they're pushing forward, right? Like LGBTQ, the whole range of things. The majority of the population are on side, and yet they push it as something they've done. It's like, well, no, Canadians are already there. And yet on economics is where the gap's getting to be a bigger gap. So an example, well, I don't know if it's a good example or not, but Trudeau elected, the younger part of the population came out in 2015 and voted for Hope. And fast forward, you mentioned protests, the truckers' protest that we had. I don't know if you saw the news, the shutdown Ottawa and a couple of borders. The group that was most supportive or most thought that they were legitimate and we should have sympathy for the truckers was young people. Mm-hmm. So they voted for Hope, and the 7 years later, and this was, it was about mandates, but it was really about economic challenges that the country's facing. They said, you know what? I think the truckers are right. I think there are challenges we have to face. So it seems like the focus on culture, that all of those young people agree that's the right thing, we're on side. Yeah. Is lost to them, because they're like, but you're not following suit on the other side of the economic agenda, which allows me to get a house, right? Like, it's great that we're all treated fairly, but I still don't have a house to live in.
Yeah, I mean, we're working on some stuff here. So it builds on the book and the generational differences. On, if you think of the classic two axes of economic left-right and vertical liberal to authoritarian, or, you know, whatever you put on the ends of the kind of cultural axis, there is something about those being increasingly interconnected, or seeming increasingly interconnected, because quite a lot of it, I think, is related to how you see the world, as whether you see it as down to the individual and, you know, because you get on with it and you've got your own, you look after yourself, or you see it as structural, where there is something holding you back or helping you forward. And I think that type of importance of, are there structural things holding people back, whether that's generations or particular races, is becoming increasingly blurred between the cultural and the economic. And that's really interesting for the future. Thinking about the future is actually the distinction between the economic and the cultural is going to get increasingly blurred. That is a worry in some ways, because this is what I worry about from a UK perspective is we are buying the culture war rhetoric wholesale, absolutely wholesale. We've got a study coming out with Ipsos UK soon on exactly that kind of measuring media content about how they're talking about cancel culture and wokeism, and comparing that with public attitudes on those types of issues. And you can see that the incredible expansion in media focus on wokeism and cancel culture has absolutely fed into public opinion about putting this as a more divisive thing in the country.
Yeah, the more we agree on the social side, the less cohesive we are, it seems.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I worry about is U.S. style culture wars. We did an academic literature review on the culture wars literature in the U.S. And it's not disagreement between people. This is two fundamentally opposing worldviews where there's no compromise, where mm-hmm. you just reject the other side's worldview out of hand, and then it becomes attached to the identities, the group identities that people have, where the issues don't really matter, and it just becomes more about I dislike the other side. That's the risks I think a lot of us face, a lot of different countries face, is stumbling stroke, some people deliberately pushing us towards this sense of cultural division that
it's
becomes
like soccer hooliganism.
Exactly, it becomes about a badge much more than any kind of reasoned debate. I mean, I don't want to overblow that in the sense of a lot of our work shows, yeah, the media are talking about this a lot, but actually when you talk to people in the street, real people about it, they're not nearly as divided as the impression you get in the media on it. But I think one of the lessons from the US is you can create that sense of division top down if you keep going on about it for a long enough time.
So Bobby, do you have a roadmap for the way forward or steps that we need to take in order to bring the generations together? Is it just better analysis, better communication?
Yeah, that's good. I mean, obviously, like all these books, it ends with the 10 things we need to do. They all have to have that type of thing. I think one of the biggest things is about separation, generational separation. And we've drifted into this world where we are physically living in very different places, which is really easy to forget that that's brand new. And both very similar analysis of US and UK about how it used to be pretty age integrated as societies in where we live. And now it's incredibly well sorted into cities with young people and older people living outside. And that's new for humans. We haven't really had that in our whole history, is this age-based separation. Then if you layer on top of that digital separation in the way that you described, Mike, actually, about young people are on different platforms doing different things in different sorts of communities to older people. It's true, more older people are online, more doing more things, but they're still not connecting with young people who are in separate communities. So you've got this physical and digital separation. And that's in many ways the biggest thing to try to fight against. We've drifted into this age division and we need to be much more ambitious in bringing the generations together. Because when you do, what you see is all these stereotypes and conflicts kind of melt away. We're quite well connected across the generations. We care about each other and deeply through our families and things.
And I never thought about that. That's an excellent point. The rise of seniors communities. It's
just sort of happened.
Suburbs. Yeah, just suburbs where we're like, this is. Well, it's happened, and in some cases it's specific, right? There are communities in Ontario, in Canada, where they promote themselves as a great place to retire.
Absolutely.
Right? The house prices are down. It's a little further from the big cities, but we have this, and this, and it's a great place to come and retire. So guess what you're going to get in those communities? An older population and fewer elementary schools. And I never thought about the connection. It's a good point. Do you see an answer now that we're making you cast forward and use your crystal ball? So if homeownership was the middle class dream, or at least a significant signal on the way to the middle class dream, which would be autonomy through retirement, a better life for the next generation if you have children, et cetera, that evaporates, or it has for many people started to evaporate. Mm. Is there a replacement for it?
I don't want to talk about housing through too much throughout this, but I do see it as quite core to this. And I do think what you need is much more of a comprehensive plan on housing in all these countries, which includes how do you help people into ownership, but it also includes how do you better regulate or support private rented housing and social housing where you have that in countries, because we just again hugely neglected this in this gold rush of private home ownership, wealth increase, and we just ignored everything else. And you will need we've had big increases in kids staying at home longer into their late 20s and early 30s. So you need something to help people out of the home. And then you need something to help them establish that's not going to take up 80% of their income in just paying their rent. So there's a whole housing market aspect to that element of improving things for young people. I think beyond that, though, there is all of the things that we worry about, going back to your point, Mike, about lack of imagination and no big ideas in politics or policy right now. I think that is absolutely the crux of it. We thought the pandemic would be maybe a spark for some new deals that actually meant something for people. But it always felt a bit optimistic because you do tend...
became a check writing exercise.
And now an inflation exercise.
Yes, exactly. And we haven't even seen the start of this cost of living crisis, only just starting for people. So
here's some good news, I think.
Yeah.
On the housing issue. In the media, and this is anecdotally just from what I've read, we're starting to see media commentary link in large part because of government commentary. Immigration rates in Canada have been on fire the last couple of years, right? Set aside 2020. But prior to that, before that, it's been record number of immigrants. And now they're saying, and we just haven't kept up with housing. People are starting to say, well, hang on, the policymakers should sit down and have that discussion together. If you're bringing in more people, you need to have more places for them to live. What an error you made over the last 10, 15 years. The good news is we don't see a decline in public support for immigration or ethnic diversity. So it's not turning into a backlash. If it's turning into a backlash, it's against the policymakers.
Yeah, it's a reprimand against our leaders.
Not against other individuals and saying, why are you here, right? So hopefully some of that in this, to your point, on generations or on sort of long, slow social shifts, right? We bought in on the importance of immigration, on the importance of diversity, on the need for and the value, it's so far anyway. And we aren't seeing you know how we can solve this. Let's push back against those who don't look like us sort of deal, which I think is a positive. So
that's good. And I mean, there are other positives. Like I say, climate change brings people together, really, in large part, across the age ranges and across the generations now. So there is, obviously, it's complex in particular, but the overall feeling is there is that sense of division is not there. There is a lot of support among younger people for continuing support for older people because they do... that there is no sense of trying to rob the old to, you know, give younger people a better start. Younger people themselves don't believe that and don't want to see that happen. So there's much more connection and common objectives here than can come across. And that is an important thing to hold on to.
Now, Mike, you had one final question about vegetables. Is that right?
I don't know if it's a vegetable or not. It's about potatoes. So, Bobby, what's worse for me, social media or potatoes?
Surely it's a vegetable. Okay, what else would it?
Well, it's got to be a vegetable. Is it a grain? I don't know.
It's a vegetable. I'm of the view that things that grow in the dirt aren't, you know, really something you want. Venture carrots, beets, potatoes. You know, particularly if they're mashed, that's not a good thing. So, but anyway, let's set aside my taste. Yep. What's there's a link in the book between the two, social media and potatoes.
Yeah. I was distracted by going to challenge you on your love of vodka, and I will leave that.
We'll discuss that when I'm in the UK next time.
Yeah. So this is a massively important debate. So there's a couple of realities. There's one big reality here, which is that mental health disorders, common mental health disorders among young people have been on the rise. And they've been on the rise, particularly among young women across lots of different countries. And there is an awful lot of discussion about the cause of that. Really important issue to understand the cause of this. And there has been a knee-jerk reaction to blame smartphones or social media in particular for this, that this is the cause of it. And a lot of the evidence, you know, there's some correlation type evidence of timing looks about right, not quite right, in terms of the rises and the fact that women do different sorts of things. Young women tend to be on different sorts of platforms online compared to men. It seems that there's an a priori reason to think there could be a connection there. But the problem is that it's very difficult to find evidence of a connection when you look at it in different sorts of ways about high social media users versus lows, no real correlation. And one of the studies that did this to kind of challenge the dominant narrative just put loads of variables into a model about what's most associated with common mental health disorders, and found that eating potatoes is more related to common mental health disorders than how much social media you consume. So there is so on the one hand, I'm a little conflicted about this one because the evidence is not really there for it that strongly on correlation. Oh, the potatoes. I'm not conflicted about potatoes. I quite like. Yeah.
Sorry.
I guess our potatoes are proxy for income, for example. I don't know.
I have very straightforward views on potatoes, but the cause of this, there is, you know, it's very respected academics. Jonathan Haidt, Gene Twenge, who are very clear in their mind that there is a connection here. The evidence doesn't quite fit so far. And even all those studies you'll see that were leaked by Facebook about how they know that there is a connection between particular uses of their platform are still these correlational ones where you can't really tell what's going on and what's causing what here. So equally, though, I think so the risk is here, just to finish up on that point, is the risk is we have this common bias in our mind called fundamental attribution bias, where we will look for the one cause of something because it makes things simpler for us to not have to think through complex models of what might be causing this. And it also gives us one clear thing to blame, that if we just sorted out social media platforms or banned or reduced use, then that would take away this trend in increased common mental health disorders. So the risk of just jumping to that is that you don't look at the whole picture and you end up doing something that doesn't help that much. So that's the risk and why I challenge it in the book. But on the other hand, you can also wait around for ages for proper causational type evidence, and then you miss the chance to act on something that is important. So I think we need to get the balance right on this of actually looking seriously at whether social media and technology more generally is an issue here, while bearing in mind that we have a real tendency to moral panic about every new technology that comes in. We will always blame it, from printing press through telephones, through movies, through bicycles was one. There's a moral panic around bicycles, through to obviously video nasties and then video games. We've got this kind of long trend of this is always going to be the thing that ruins young people, and it's seldom the case.
Our goal on this show is to have guests that are smarter than both Mike and I combined. It's a low bar, admittedly, but you've exceeded it very easily. So thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, my friend.
No worries. That was excellent. Really enjoyed that.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Educated Conjecture. Follow us on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts for another episode of Public Opinion and Informed Insights. If you have a topic you'd like to see covered on an upcoming episode, please send us an email at publicaffairs@ipsos.com. That's publicaffairs@ipsos.com.